This is Explorers Podcast number 39, Mary Anning, English Explorer of the Jurassic World. It's October 22nd, 2011, and welcome to the 39th episode of Explorers Podcast, brought to you by 66south.com. I'm Tom Ingalls. In this episode, we're going to talk about Mary Anning, a self-educated, working-class woman from a small seaside town in southern England who became one of the most celebrated fossil hunters of all time. With her brother Joseph, Mary Anning found the first complete ichthyosaur in 1811, and she was only 12 years old when she made this discovery, and it would turn out to be the first of many important paleontological finds for her and the scientific community. Mary Anning's discoveries provided evidence central to the development of new ideas about the history of the Earth and the development of the scientific field we call paleontology. Before we continue, if you've downloaded this podcast from iTunes, you'll want to look at the pictures shown throughout the podcast that will show up on your listening device. I've included artists' renderings of some of Mary's discoveries as they are described during this podcast. And if you're not able to see these pictures, then go to 66south.com, click on the tab called Explorer's Image Index, and then click on the image of Mary Anning. So who was Mary Anning? Mary Anning was born to Richard and Mary Anning on May 21st, 1799, in the southern coastal English town of Lyme Regis in Dorset. Mary was one of nine children born to Richard and Mary, and she and her brother Joseph were the only children to survive to adulthood. Mary's father, Richard, was a cabinet maker, and that really didn't cover the bills for the family. And just like about every other resident of Lyme Regis at that time, the Annings were very poor. And to help put food on the table, Mary's father, Richard, spent his free time collecting fossils in the cliffside fossil beds near the town and selling these fossils to wealthy tourists. As a young child, Mary and her brother Joseph tagged along with their father in the search for these fossils. For Mary, fossils turned into more than just a source of money. They became a lifelong passion for her. And I should note that at the time that Mary was a child, no one knew what fossils were. They were thought to be shell fragments, teeth and bones from dead crocodiles and alligators. Dinosaurs hadn't been discovered yet, and the whole idea of extinction was considered heresy by the devoutly religious culture that took the Bible literally and felt that God would not create a species that would eventually go extinct like the dinosaurs did. At the time, the most convincing explanation to people was that these fossils were the remains of creatures that had died during Noah's flood and had been buried as the Earth's crust reformed. I want to briefly describe the town of Lyme Regis because it plays an important part in the story of Mary Anning for several reasons. In the early 1800s in England, it was becoming fashionable for the wealthier English citizens to bathe or simply immerse themselves in salt water for health reasons and wellness purposes. And Lyme Regis was becoming something of a summer seaside resort for these bathers. And these wealthy tourists turned out to be a source of much needed income for the Anning family, and in fact for many other families in the small community of Lyme Regis, because these tourists would purchase fossils from the locals as souvenirs. Lyme Regis is loaded with fossils, and the whole area around Lyme Regis is now commonly referred to as Jurassic Coast. Jurassic Coast measures about 150 kilometers or almost 100 miles along the coast of southern England and stretches from near the town of Exmouth in East Devon to all the way to the East Dorset. And Jurassic Coast is now a World Heritage Site. And in fact, It is England's first natural World Heritage Site. And the Jurassic Coast consists of Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous cliffs that span what is called the Mesozoic Era, which is an era of about 180 million years of geological history. So I guess you could say that Mary Anning was living right in the heart of the land of the dinosaurs, or at least fossilized dinosaurs, and she didn't know that, and nobody else knew that, because dinosaurs hadn't even been discovered yet. So, but tragedy struck early in Mary's life when she was 10 years old, when her father, Richard, who was only 44 years old at the time, died from tuberculosis. And this left Mary's family destitute. Their main source of income pretty much became charity. And it appears that after her father died, Mary stopped going to school altogether so that she could help make money for the family. But her education didn't stop. It just changed. Her education, in fact, would continue for a lifetime in the rocks of Lyme Regis. And what an education it would turn out to be. In 1811, a year after her father's death, Mary's brother Joseph was walking along some fallen rocks between Lyme Regis and the town of Charmouth, and he noticed what appeared to him to be the head of a crocodile fossil in the rocks. And he didn't pay too much attention to the fossil, but he did tell his sister Mary about it. And she was pretty curious, and a year later, in 1812, 12-year-old Mary decided to go check it out. And she did find it. She found the fossilized head and then began scouting around in the cliff above the location of the head. And 9 meters up, or 30 feet up the cliff, she found the rest of the body that belonged to the head. And it was huge. When the complete skeleton, or fossilized skeleton, had been excavated, it measured 5 meters, that's 17 feet in length, and it was almost in pristine condition. And this find created a huge stir amongst the scientific community in London, and the lord of the manor at Lyme Regis, his name was Henry Host Henley, bought the fossil from the Annings for 23 English pounds, and then gave it to a museum in London. 23 English pounds was a lot of money at that time. Today, 23 pounds is equivalent to over 500 pounds, or about $1,000 US. And so that was really helpful for the struggling Anning family. And at that time, nobody had any idea what this creature was. In some ways, it looked like a lizard, but it also had a lot of features that fish had. So it was given the name ichthyosaur, which literally means fish lizard. It wasn't the first ichthyosaur fossil to be found, but it was the first complete ichthyosaur fossil to be found. Mary found the whole skeleton, not just a jawbone or a skull, but the whole thing. After Mary's big discovery in 1912, she continued to search the cliffs near her home for more fossils. And being a paleontologist requires a lot of patience. And it wasn't for another 9 years before Mary's next big find. And in May 1821, Mary unearthed another ichthyosaur. This was a much smaller species that has the scientific name Ichthyosaurus communis. And like her first one, it was in perfect condition, and she sold that one to a museum as well, a museum in Bristol. Later that same year, again, we're in 1821, she found another fossil, but it wasn't in very good condition, and it was missing many parts of its body. And she didn't pay too much attention to it. She didn't really know what she had found, and she wouldn't know until her huge discovery just 2 years later. And on December 10th, 1823, while scouting around the foot of Black Venn Cliff, Mary spotted a skull that looked different than anything else she had ever seen. She worked through the night in freezing cold conditions to unearth the rest of the fossilized skeleton, and when she was done, she had a creature that measured 3 meters or 9 feet in length. And the fact that the skeleton was 3 meters in length wasn't as surprising as the fact that the head was only 11 centimeters, that's about 4.5 inches in length. That's a really small head for a 3 meter long body. An 11 centimeter head is smaller than a bocce ball or an American softball. Imagine something like that on a 3 meter long body. Like the ichthyosaur that Mary and her brother discovered when she was 12 years old, nobody knew what this creature was. And the debate amongst the scientists at the time is pretty funny to read. Deborah Cadbury's book entitled Terrible Lizard is a good book to check out if you want to see a bunch of guys, and yes, they were all guys, bicker about what this thing was. It would eventually be called a plesiosaur, or using a scientific name, Plesiosaurus giganteus. And Mary Anning had discovered the very first complete fossil of a plesiosaur ever. Mary would learn from this fossil that the mysterious and fragmented one that she had found 2 years earlier was also that of a plesiosaur. Unlike the earlier fossil, though, this one was in great condition. It was the complete skeleton of the ancient plesiosaur. The word plesiosaur means close to reptiles. In other words, it sort of looked like a reptile, but not quite. It also had some fishy qualities to it, too, but it wasn't as fishy as an ichthyosaur was. And to paraphrase the description of a noted paleontologist of the time, Mary's fossil had the head of a lizard, the teeth of a crocodile, the neck of a snake, the ribs of a chameleon, and the paddles of a whale. So Mary had found a complete fossil of a plesiosaur, and she had also, earlier when she was 12, had found a complete fossil of an ichthyosaur. And the fact that she had found complete fossils of individuals of these two groups is really important, because otherwise, you know, people before her, they had found maybe a bone or a rib or a jawbone or a tooth from an ichthyosaur or a plesiosaur, but they really had no context for knowing what it was or whether or not it was important. And the fact that Mary had found a complete fossilized skeleton showed that all of these, what seemed to be pieces from different animals, like a lizard or a crocodile or a snake or a chameleon or a whale, all belonged to the same individual. And that's what really got everybody all excited, was these were really crazy-looking animals that nobody had ever seen before. And in fact, Mary's descriptions of, and others' descriptions of Mary's plesiosaur seem to have been the inspiration for the description of what some people call, but have never seen, the Loch Ness Monster. After this big discovery, in the mid-1820s, Mary went on to discover a variety of fossil fish, including a primeval shark that had a large dorsal spine, and she also discovered what were called coprolites. And she hypothesized that these coprolites, which were like stones that you could hold in your hands, that these were fossils of partially digested food and fossilized feces of prehistoric reptiles, including ichthyosaurs. And while that may not sound like a very interesting thing, these discoveries were important because they gave an indication when they were analyzed of what ichthyosaurs ate. And it turned out that ichthyosaurs ate a lot of other critters in the sea, including other ichthyosaurs. And the fact that ichthyosaurs cannibalized each other created quite a stir amongst the scientific community at the time. One geologist, whose name was Thomas Hawkins, was horrified by the notion of ichthyosaurs eating each other. He viewed ichthyosaurs as Satan's creatures, and he wrote, quote, "Satan seems to have been thrice seized, generating horrors and realizing a teeming spawn fitted for the lowest abysm of chaos." He and others at the time wondered why God would create such hideous monsters. In December 1828, Mary had yet another major discovery to add to her growing list. And this one was a creature definitely suitable for nightmares. To Mary and others at the time, it looked like a cross between a vampire bat and a reptile. Some thought it was a flying vampire-like beast. In fact, it would later be called a pterosaur. More specifically, it was a fossil of what was initially called Pterodactylus macronix, and then later renamed Dimorphodon macronix. And at the time, it was often referred to as a flying dragon. Pterosaurs, or pterodactyls, are in fact not dinosaurs. They're closely related to dinosaurs, and they probably lived along shorelines, and they were lightweight with hollow bones and appear to have been able to fly. The pterosaur that Mary found had a wingspan of about 1.2 meters, or about 4 feet, and its skull was shaped like the beak of a puffin. It's really a weird-looking critter. And this was the first British pterosaur ever found, and pterosaurs are notoriously hard to find, even today. But it was a big discovery, and it's important to know that at the time, women were not accepted as scientists, and they were certainly not accepted as fellows of the Geological Society, or even to attend meetings at all, for that matter. So as with all of Mary's finds, it was up to some stuffy white guy to have the honor of describing her creature in lectures and in journals of the time. And in this case, and with many of her finds, it was the famous geologist William Buckland who formally presented Mary's pterosaur to the scientific community. Fortunately, though, William Buckland was, relatively speaking, a pretty nice guy and made it clear to everyone that this was Mary's discovery. And Mary really became a real celebrity because of this discovery, and not only in the scientific community, but amongst the general population. And the public just couldn't get enough of this pterosaur. I think it's mainly because it was such a scary-looking creature. The whole idea of a flying reptile was terrifying. And even William Buckland, the scientist, played this up in his scientific paper, which he published in the Transactions of the Geological Society of London in 1929. And if you dig into the archives and actually read that paper, you'll find the following quote in that paper. He writes, quote, "It somewhat resembled our modern bats and vampires, but had its beak elongated like the bill of a woodcock, and armed with teeth like the snout of a crocodile. Its vertebrae, ribs, pelvis, legs, and feet resembled those of a lizard. Its three anterior fingers terminated in long hooked claws like that on the forefinger of a bat. And over its body was a covering of scaly armor like that of an iguana. In short, a monster resembling nothing that has ever been seen or heard of upon Earth, excepting the dragons of romance and heraldry." I love that quote, especially since it's in a pretty boring and stuffy scientific journal. Charles Dickens, in fact, was pretty dramatic when he wrote, quote, "Even if pre-Adamite man is ever proved to have been existing at that time, we cannot imagine his wife making pets of them, or his children liking to have them hung around the house in cages. They have such a family likeness to the evil spirits who beset Aeneas or Satan in an old illustrated Virgil or Paradise Lost." So, a lot of hubbub over that discovery. A year after finding the pterosaur, Mary made her fourth major discovery, and this time it was a new fossil fish called Squalaraja. And this is a crazy-looking fish, and Mary had a hard time trying to describe it because she couldn't compare it to anything else known at the time. It measured about a half a meter, or 1.5 feet in length, And at first, it was thought to be some sort of a mix between a shark and a ray. And it wouldn't be for many years later that it would be known as a species within the order Chimeriformes, or Chimera. And the Chimera has a body that looks kind of like an otter's body, and has a, but they also have a flat tail like a beaver's. It's really bizarre. The name Chimera, by the way, was taken from Greek mythology. In Greek mythology, a chimera is a monstrous fire-breathing female creature with the head and body of a lion, a tail that ends with a snake's head, and there's a head of a goat that grows out of its back, so pretty weird stuff. The following year, in December 1830, Mary had her fifth major discovery, and this time it was another species of plesiosaur. This one was called Plesiosaurus macrocephalus, which basically means big-headed plesiosaur. It was called that because it had a head nearly twice the size of any previous plesiosaur found, so that was a pretty big find. And inspired by Mary Anning's findings, in May 1830, a scientist and a pretty good drawer by the name of Henry de la Beche drew an illustration that he named Duria Antiquure, which means ancient Dorset. Dorset being that part of England where all of this was happening. And this illustration is filled with all sorts of ancient reptiles. It shows an ancient ocean filled with predatory plesiosaurs and ichthyosaurs, and they're locked in combat. Overhead, there are pterodactyls circling. And this drawing was a sensation. Everybody wanted to have a copy of it so that they could hang it on their own walls. Everybody wanted something to show these amazing ancient dinosaurs and reptiles that Mary and others were finding at the time. And really, this fascination with dinosaurs has really never ended. It's still alive today. 2 years later, in 1832, Mary found another ichthyosaur, and this one was huge. It measured nearly 7 meters, or 22 and a half feet in length, and it was called Temnodontosaurus platyodon. And this is one of the largest ichthyosaurs ever found to date, and it's really amazing to look at just by sheer size alone. It's an incredibly large marine organism. And in fact, these creatures have some of the largest eyes of any known vertebrate. The eye of a Temnodontosaurus is about 20 centimeters or 8 inches in diameter. So, big eyes. Mary was now 30 years old, and she had made 5 major discoveries in the field of paleontology. But this fifth discovery really marked the end of her major finds. In 1835, the British Association for the Advancement of Science and the British government together provided Mary with a pension that amounted to about £25 a year. And that was a pretty good sum of money at the time and helped to provide her with a comfortable living for the remainder of her life. And over the following decade, Mary continued to scour the cliffs near Lyme Regis, collecting fossils. But as I said, none of these were on the scale of her earlier discoveries. And in 1845, just before her 46th birthday, Mary began to suffer from lethargy and weight loss. She also noticed a lump in her breast that wouldn't go away. By the following year, in 1846, she was growing weaker and sicker, but she continued to search for fossils in the cliffs around the town of Lyme Regis, and it was in that year, at the age of 47, that Mary was diagnosed with breast cancer. And on March 9th, 1847, at the age of 47, Mary Anning died. A few months after her death, the Geological Society of London made her an honorary member of their institution. And this was the first time that a woman had been named an honorary member of that society. And it wouldn't be for another 60 years before women were allowed to become fellows. Mary was buried in the churchyard of St. Michael the Archangel on Church Street in Lyme Regis. And her obituary was printed in the Quarterly Journal of the Geological Society. A few years later, in 1850, a stained glass window designed by William Wales was placed in St. Michael's Church in memory of Mary Anning. And this stained glass depicts the six acts of mercy in the Bible, that being visiting the sick, feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, giving clothing for the naked, sheltering the homeless, and visiting orphans. Below the stained glass window reads, quote, "This window is sacred to Mary Anning of this parish, who died A.D. 1847, and is erected by the Vicar of Lyme and some of the members of the Geological Society of London in commemoration of her usefulness in furthering the science of geology, as also of benevolence of heart and integrity of life." And as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, in 2001, the entire coastline running up and down that part of England, with Lyme Regis right in the middle of that part of coastline, was declared England's first natural world heritage site, giving what is now called Jurassic Coast equal stature to the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. The great scientist and biologist and paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould wrote, quote, "Mary Anning is probably the most important unsung or inadequately unsung collecting force in the history of paleontology. She directly found or pointed the way to nearly every specimen of importance." And I want to close with the words of Anning biographer Patricia Pierce, who wrote, quote, "Mary Anning was not a village blue stocking, not a dainty romantic, not a feminist, not an adventuress. She was herself, tough, strong, humble, plain, practical, honest, curious, intelligent, and with the intellectual mastery of her subject." And that concludes this episode on Mary Anning, English explorer of the Jurassic world. The Explorers Podcast is brought to you by 66south.com. If you have any comments or suggestions on this podcast or on anything posted on the website, please feel free to contact me through the ways posted on 66south.com. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more. Please meet you.